Welcome to Worlds Apart. Most Western intellectuals would agree that technology is rapidly changing the world we live in, with one caveat: it is somehow supposed to keep in place the old hierarchy of power, with the West dictating and taking advantage of most economic and political decisions. How far is the West willing to go in fighting the inevitable? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Warwick Powell, an adjunct professor at Queensland University of Technology in Australia. Professor Powell, it's great to talk to you. Thank you very much for your time.
A pleasure to be here.
Now, in your writing, you argue that the world is now at the technological point where nations, by investing their human capital and resources smartly, can truly attain technological sovereignty and be, if not totally free, then at least less dependent on the American technology and the US dollar. When do you see this trend reaching its momentum?
I think that the processes have been in place for actually probably 30 years, running in parallel with the emergence of American big tech and the dominance of the American big tech model. The American big tech model has been anchored in this idea of rent-seeking rights that can be that enable them to accrue super profits through the control of infrastructure and the prohibition of others from either developing and implementing their own infrastructure and, of course, running applications on top of that infrastructure. In parallel to that process has been, in some regards, an underground movement that has lived on the edges or the peripheries of the technological social landscape. Some of that has been in the libertarian fringes of the American body politic, particularly in areas of cryptography and the open source movement, who have been for a long time incredibly concerned at the growing power and the centralization of authority that comes with the American big tech model. The other part of the American big tech model is that it's not just a feature of the private capitalist market. In fact, quite the reverse. American big tech would not be what it is without the longstanding multi-decade support of the American government, particularly through Department of Defense and Pentagon funding and institutions such as DARPA, which has supported so-called dual-use research and development. We've reached a point in time, an inflection point in human history, where these technologies are being grasped by large organizations and countries as a set of tools to extricate themselves from the shackles of American big tech and techno-feudalism and create platforms and infrastructure that support ambitions of national sovereignty. Over the next 10 years, I would expect that these regimes, these technology regimes, will begin to flourish in many parts of the world.
Now, I suppose it's not just technology regimes, but also economic, financial, and political arrangements that allow for the creation of a truly international system, as you call it, with a hyphen, meaning that it's based on sovereignty and it's based on the idea that nations engage with each other in pursuit of their own benefit. And I wonder, I find this notion of benefit, of interest, of personal or, you know, national need to be central here, because for some reason, somehow, this American rent-seeking behavior doesn't see this very crucial aspect of human psychology, both on collective and individual level, that people actually, their needs need to be satisfied, whether you like it or not.
Well, I think, again, like with most things, there's a historical context which helps us understand the state that we're in. And the historical context is the evolution, I guess, of liberalism as a doctrine from the West that really had a way of thinking about what civilization meant. And within liberalism, civilization largely revolved around a very particular idea of the individual. And that idea was that the individual was a free, autonomous individual that existed separate from social relationships, and that that free individual imbued with the qualities of rationality would be able to surpass the dynamics of collective will and culture. So that was the idea. Now, on the other side of that idea was what was seen to be the uncivilized person that had to be overcome. And the uncivilized person was the person who identified themselves as part of a social group, as part of a cultural environment, and responded and behaved within a social context. And that was seen to be an uncivilized, almost barbaric kind of way of being human. So this goes to the heart of how we understand what being human means. And so for 300, 400 years, liberalism has sought to shape individuals in this particular sense.
Well, it's interesting now, that it seems to be shaping not only individuals, but also, you know, large, you know, collective groups like the United States, because it in fact behaves on an international stage like an individual who only has view of his own interests and totally unconnected to the world around him, not only in, you know, disregarding what other things or need, but also disregarding the basic reality or the basic history of the world.
Yeah, look, it's a way of thinking about yourself and your place in the world and relationship to it. So when you see yourself as a detached individual, whether you see that as an individual biological being or individual as a collective, such as a nation, you really don't have a sense that what's good for you is intrinsically connected to what's happening around you, and that somehow you're able to set yourself apart from everything else and dictate to that world around you what it is that you want and how it is that you'll go about achieving that. And we've seen that in many dimensions. You know, prior to the emergence of American hegemony over the last 70 years, we saw it, of course, in British imperialism. And more broadly, coming out of the West, we saw a particular view about technology and human beings and their relationship to nature, which viewed nature as simply something that human beings could literally conquer and exploit. So there's in a sense, a philosophical package deal, a cultural package deal that emanated out of the Enlightenment that has underpinned the ways in which technologies have been mobilized and the ways in which a particular hegemonic power has ultimately straddled the global landscape. Now, that era is coming to an end.
I want to mention that you coined the term digital Westphalia, and you suggest that it may come to supersede Western dominance. Now, when we talk about Westphalia, the history nerds among us would know that the Peace of Westphalia enshrined sovereignty as the basic principle of international relations and recognition that countries ultimately act in their own interest. So there was, you know, a sort of different philosophical underpinning within the West too. And what's important to me is that that Peace of Westphalia came after 30 years war. Do you think the emergence of the digital Westphalia would require such sacrifices?
Well, we hope that it doesn't become bloody, but you know, provided that some sense can prevail at a global level, then maybe we can avoid the bloodshed that led to the original treaties of Westphalia in the 1600s. The challenge we have, of course, is that waning powers don't let go willingly and will seek wherever they can to cling on to what they have. And if they can't cling on to it, they're happy to bring the whole house down. And I think one of the dangerous components of the current moment is that there is a strong eschatological element, which draws on a deeply Judeo-Christian thread of thinking about the world and about right and wrong and about good and evil. And that kind of dualism is the piece that gives the impetus to those who seek not to negotiate and work with others in the world, but to overcome others in the world.
Yes. But Professor Powell, I understand this issue of power and dominance, but there is also, an important element of self-preservation, which is instinctual. And I think it could be argued that stability and sort of smart effort to allocate your resources and your efforts could be key, if not vital, at the time of major transitions which we live in. And I would also argue that developed countries where populations are far less tempered by hardship than in many other parts of the world need that more than anyone else, because you need to have all your ducks in a row in order to deal with phenomena that are outside your control, like, for example, natural disasters or even large migration flows. There are lots and lots of, huge problems in the world that even the United States, with its super ego, cannot deal with alone. And yet it seems that the West is banned on wasting its safety cushion that it has accumulated over centuries as fast as possible. How do you explain that?
I think it's very hard to explain, because in some regards you would think that that kind of self-destructive behavior is irrational. So there are kinds of rationalities which help us understand what drives these behaviors. And as I touched on before, some of those rationalities go to that sense of dualism, that belief that they represent all that is good and everything else is all that is evil. And when you've got that flowing through or coursing through your veins, then you can just about rationalize anything. I think that's part of the explanation. I think that there is also some autoimmunity effects that are going on from a systems point of view, and that is that in moments of desperation, as you feel your authority and the world around you that you thought you knew very well and controlled slip through your fingers, your first reaction is to try to stem the flow, to hold that back, to block the flow from happening. But the problem is that what often takes place as a result is that you cause more harm to yourself. And this is what happens in system immunity responses, where you think you're attacking, or your body thinks it's attacking the threat to your system, but in fact it ends up hurting itself. And I think that a lot of that's going on. And you see that all over the place where, for example, the weaponization of technology in the name of preserving liberty and freedom and democracy and all those things actually undermines liberty, freedom and democracy and all those things. And we have reached a stage where I think that the global majority, if you will, have realized what's going on and have simply prepared themselves to move on.
Okay, well, what exactly that global majority is doing in order to prepare itself to move on, we will discuss in a couple of minutes. Stay tuned.
I'm Rick Sanchez, and I'm here to plead with you, whatever you do, do not watch my new show. Seriously, why watch something that's so different? Why listen to opinions that you won't get anywhere else? Look, if it pleases you to have the State Department, the CIA, weapons makers, multi-billion dollar corporations choose your facts for you, go ahead. Why change? And whatever you do, don't watch my show. Stay mainstream, because I'm probably going to make you uncomfortable. My show is called Direct Impact. But again, you probably don't want to watch it, because it might just change the way you think.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Warwick Powell, an adjunct professor at Queensland University of Technology in Australia. Professor Powell, before the break, we were discussing various forms of weaponizing the existing financial or technological infrastructure, but I think there is also a pretty clear trend on picking up battles, literal battles with countries that can actually afford themselves technological sovereignty. I mean, first and foremost, Russia and China. Do you think this technological rise of the rest can be stopped or reversed by this, I would claim, very intentional breeding of insecurity by the West, using insecurity as a strategy to sort of cling on to, you know, the passing away privileges?
Look, I don't think it can be stopped. In many ways, the technology genie is out of the bottle now. And what that means is that the tools are available for people around the world and nations to build the hardware and the software that they need to protect the environments that they hold to be important, the informational environment that they hold to be important. So when countries or businesses, enterprises in countries trade and conduct commerce with others, rather than an operating system which requires a massive amount of data to be basically shared through server farms in New York or in other parts of the United States, which enables United States authorities to intervene and in effect surveil data flows. And of course, if they so want, to censor data flows, to block the flow of funds, to sanction transactions, et cetera, et cetera. Now, once you've got the digital pipes, the underground cables, the satellite networks, the data centers that enable your information infrastructure to operate independently of that, the next thing you need are operating systems. And what we have is the development of, at scale, very robust operating systems based on open source platforms and technologies, whether it's in software applications or even in the design of microprocessor chips. So open source becomes the next frontier. The next thing that gets built on top of that is actually a new set of standards. The standards that the world will begin to operate by, at least the global majority, will be open source standards. And the reason why open source standards matter is that it enables interoperability between what are otherwise autonomous Westphalian-like digital ecosystems. Now, the last thing that will get built from an infrastructure point of view is an array of cryptographic tools. Now, cryptography is in essence the mathematics of keeping secrets. And the need to ensure information flows only when and where it needs to flow to the right people, to the right counterparties, and not to others, is actually going to be a baked-in feature of the new technology landscape. And that's a good thing because it enables nation states and the enterprises and individuals in those nation states to continue to conduct intercourse with those in other parts of the world without fear that that information will create threats to themselves or to their country.
Okay, they can operate outside the reach of the Western whip, so to say. And I think it's important to add that it is in the interest of non-Western players to share that technology with other countries, as they do very rapidly, in order to essentially realize their own view of the world that is truly international with a hyphen in between, that can also act as a system of, balances and counterweights for, too tyrannical accumulation of power. And that's a paradox in and of itself, that the United States, while preaching or extolling the values of democracy, is actually conducting itself in a very bare-knuckled, very despotic or very capricious way. And my question about that is not ideological. I wonder, why do you think the United States has abandoned this, you know, craft of traditional classical diplomacy? Is it because it doesn't feel the need for it? It doesn't feel the need for negotiating with other countries, or simply because it cannot do that anymore?
I think in large part, the sugar high of unipolarity over the last 30 years has actually hollowed out the wellspring of statecraft capabilities within the institutions of the American political system. And it has essentially lived off the vapors of Pax Americana, where it could dictate terms to everybody in the world, and it did. And it didn't any longer have the skills needed to negotiate with others. And I think this raises a very fundamental issue about what being a great power means in an era of multipolarity. And the question really is whether one can sustain a position or an approach where the great powers literally expropriate from the rest of the world, or the great powers actually empower the rest of the world. And that's the paradox, because to be a great power in a multipolar environment, you actually have to be generous and give power away. And when you can do that, you will actually build a very robust multipolar environment. In the technology world, I'll give you an example. Rather than holding on to all of the intellectual property, for example, in a particular set of applications or operating systems, a multipolar environment characterized by digital Westphalia will actually see leading countries invest significantly in building the skills and capabilities of applications developers and software coders and people like that in the global majority, because you want people in those parts of the world with all the skills they need to participate in this multipolar architecture.
Absolutely. That's what the Americans used to call win-win. And that brings me back to the glory days of Western hegemony, when its power was described by former U.S. Secretary of State Madeleine Albright as benevolent. And it was back then based on the idea of the United States being the global public goods provider. And the argument was exactly that the United States doesn't curse. Other countries cooperate with it willingly because they appreciate its generosity. My question to you is, are there any public goods left at this point of time that the United States genuinely shares with the rest of the world without expecting something in return?
Not at the moment. And I think we need to also remember that during this period of notional public goods provisioning, the United States did nonetheless undertake continual military interventions around the world. So, for example, between 1946 and 1990, the United States instigated 2.4 military interventions per year on average. And between 1991 and 2019, that number actually increased to 3.7 military interventions per year on average. So despite the fact that it was a dominant player, particularly in the post-Soviet period, it actually continued to pursue a kinetic first approach to how it wielded its power and authority in the world. So Madeleine Albright, I think, was a great salesperson in that regard, and it was a very nice way to help people forget that there were other parts of the American empire in terms of its overall conduct.
Well, the Americans like to say that mantra that perception is a reality, and sometimes they seem to believe in it themselves. Now, you mentioned the kinetic or military aspect of it, and clearly, you know, other countries have been, unlike the Americans, have been paying close attention to what the Americans or the West generally is doing overseas. And both Russia, China, Turkey, many other countries have fortified their militaries. But China and Russia in particular, as far as I know, China already has a larger navy than the United States. Russia has acquired an edge in the supersonic weaponry. And It's true that Western countries are modernizing their armies as well, but they are relying primarily on private contractors, so it's more expensive and far less time efficient, because both Chinese and Russian leaders can command their industries to develop in a certain way and deliver a product. My question to you is, as far as you know, can the West actually keep pace with its adversaries, given how avidly it seems to be picking up battles with them?
In terms of its manufacturing sector, it's clearly well behind, and it is going to require a substantial investment in new technologies, new robotic systems, as well as in the soft ecosystem preconditions necessary for successful modern-day manufacturing. And I mean by that design engineers, STEM graduates, etc. All of these areas are currently well short of where other countries, particularly China, Russia, and such like, are in the world. I think the other thing that's important to bear in mind is that the nature of conflict, I guess, in a multipolar environment is different from how things have been. And we're starting to see rapid developments in a range of new technologies, such as drone technologies, electronic warfare, and the role of information. And I don't mean propaganda, but I mean the ability to send signals and encrypt signals to your technologies to instruct your equipment to do things. Now, all of that is developing at a rapid pace. The material sciences are affecting things like hypersonic delivery, and I think it's going to be a real challenge for the West. The other point to bear in mind too is that the Western, and particularly the US military buildup over the last 70 years, has been undertaken in the context of a doctrine of global domination. And I mean by that a very clear doctrine in the American public policy frameworks that every part of the world is of security interest to the US. And therefore, it's had to commit to the development of a military footprint that can, in effect, intervene all across the globe and be, on their own terms, capable of fighting two wars at once. Other countries have actually had a far more modest approach to how it designs its defense spending priorities. And you'll notice that every other country does not have a global footprint, cannot project globally, but importantly, is very, very capable in their own backyards, because that's what they were designed for.
Well, the last thing I would add is that they're effective not only in their backyards, but also within their own yards, because this is ultimately the goal of the governance, to provide for your own people and to structure your spending in a way that benefits them first and foremost, rather than allows you to fight wars indefinitely. But we will have to discuss it some other time. Professor Powell, we have to leave it there. I greatly, greatly appreciate your time and wisdom with us today.
It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again on Worlds Apart. We'll be right back.